there I was, no cash, no access to my credit cards, and I had no money for gas, I had no money for lodging, nothing for food. What did I do?
In 2022, Eddie Cornell was at home in New Brunswick, Canada, when he began to hear chatter of a trucker's convoy making its way to Ottawa to protest the COVID lockdowns and vaccine mandates.
And I thought, I need to be there.
Little did he know that he would become publicly marked and have his bank account frozen.
I felt betrayed. I've never convicted of a crime. I wasn't charged of a crime. And yet my government found it necessary to label me and freeze everything I own.
Today, he is the co-founder of Veterans for Freedom and has filed a civil lawsuit against the Trudeau administration.
Citizens and ex-military people didn't return any violence. Nothing. Not a punch. Nothing. And to be beaten that way and treated like that, the world saw. They know what happened.
This is American Thought Leaders, and I'm Yanya Kelleck. Eddie Cornell, such a pleasure to have you on American Thought Leaders.
Thanks. I'm really happy to be here.
Your name is on this huge lawsuit, Cornell et al. Versus Trudeau et al. Recently, 2 years on since the truckers' convoy, High Court judge rules that the invocation of the Emergencies Act was unconstitutional. What was your reaction?
Spectacular. It was amazing. I got the call. I was in my garage. I banged my head on my tractor. I was changing the oil on it, and I was jumping up and down like I'd just won the lottery. It was amazing. I couldn't believe it. It was Christmas all over again. It was fantastic. I was beside myself.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. It seemed to me pretty obvious that what happened was going to be seen as unconstitutional looking at the actual Constitution. But for you, you say you couldn't believe it. Why?
I couldn't believe it because we'd had so many disappointments. You know, people that had challenged the measures that had been imposed on people weren't having much success. And to have a spectacular win in the federal court by a very well-respected judge really gave renewed hope to everybody that's fighting challenges at all levels of our justice system. So it took a lot of courage by Justice Mosley to actually render a decision with such far-reaching implications.
Canadian courts are kind of known to side on the side of the government, how they operate, which makes it all the more significant, I think.
It's true. And if people read the decision, you'll notice that Justice Mosley himself, in the beginning of the trial, actually thought that, and he expressed this, that he would have sided with the government. And until he actually examined all the evidence, he changed his mind. And that was great.
So you were, of course, you know, deeply involved with the truckers' convoy. Why don't we just talk a little bit about who you are? You know, you're a Canadian veteran, but, you know, tell me a little about your life trajectory, and I also want to hear about these five medals on your lapel here.
Sure. I'm just a regular guy. I joined the military when I was 18 years old. I served 22 years. I served in Cyprus under the Canadian contingent, and I received the Medal of Bravery for... Actually, I rescued a guy at sea and who was drowning. So
I just want to jump in. Like, Medal of Bravery is pretty rare award,
is,
from my understanding. Yeah,
it is. I was quite surprised to actually get one. It was just, to me, another day. I went out and I rescued the guy and I went back and did my job. So it was quite a surprise. It was very humbling for me to, you know, actually receive that type of recognition. And I try to, stay honorable in my life and be an example, and, you know, when I wear this, to conduct myself in a really appropriate manner to, you know, for everyone that came before me and everyone that's going to come after me.
Tell me a little bit about the others, actually, while we're at it. Yeah.
Sure. This one is the Medal of Peace, and we were awarded that for what was actually the Nobel Peace Prize back in '92. All the Canadians that had served under the United Nations flag. So. Which was my tour in Cyprus here. And of course, one of the, the Queen's type medals that you get for different anniversaries. And this is my long service medal with a bar, which means 22 years of service. And that's pretty much it as far as decorations, but I had a wonderful career. I was a gunner, and if, for people that don't know, that's artillery. So I don't hear so well anymore, but that's okay. A lot of things I don't really want to hear.
So explain to me how you found yourself involved in the Freedom Convoy.
Well, it's a surprising thing for me because I was sitting at home and I'd heard chatter about this convoy that was making its way to Ottawa. And I thought, I need to be there. So I got my car on a very snowy day, and I live in New Brunswick, a small town, and through a snowstorm, I drove to Ottawa, and I arrived as the trucks arrived. I tucked in with some of the convoy in and out. And the next day, the Saturday morning, when things really started to happen, I had my medals on like I do now, and I was walking around just talking to people and finding out why they were there, where they were from. Somebody noticed me on the main stage, which was the boom truck stage that everybody's probably seen. They grabbed me and pulled me up on the stage. I gave a pep talk basically to, I think there was upwards of 50,000 people standing there. I got noticed and they realized, hey, there's an ex-military guy here. And I ended up working with some of the greatest people I've ever met in my life behind the scenes to assist the truckers logistically so that, you know, they could get their message across and be able to support the people that were there with all kinds of other, you know, getting fuel, food, and having, you know, the garbage removed and just helping out in that way because they really, you know, organically came across the country and worked together, and I had to be part of it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people that I've spoken with from the convoy have an almost identical story in this. They just heard something's happening and they have to come. I want to dig into that a little bit more. You said, I have to be there. Why?
I wish I could put it into words. I can't quantify it. It was a calling. And once I was there, I knew as a veteran, this is something that I need to tell other veterans to do. So I put a video out.
My name's Eddie Cornell.
It took off across the country. I called Stand To. And to you know, a person of a military background, it means you need to come and defend your position now. And they came by the hundreds to Ottawa in support. We were there to support the truckers and their families in any way that we could. And I don't mean violently, I mean in a very peaceful way. And to show them that we're standing with them and we agree with what they're standing here for.
What were you standing for?
Basically freedom from mandates and also from lockdowns. And it wasn't there to overthrow the government like they tried to paint that narrative. I mean, people came with barbecues and snow shovels and bouncy castles, and you know, that's not how people arrive when they're trying to overthrow a government. So these were the most peaceful people I've ever seen in my lifetime. They were people of all races, all backgrounds. We came together, stood shoulder to shoulder, and tried to get a message to the government that what you're doing is wrong and you need to listen. And they didn't.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the government reaction. And of course, this is in the court documents as well. But tell me about that from your perspective.
Initially, you know, the Ottawa Police Service, they were great. And they were there to just keep an eye on things. And there really was no issues. People were shoveling the sidewalks. People were cleaning the garbage. There was food available, and it was a fantastic scene. And then something changed. All of a sudden, you saw those people from the police services that were very supportive being removed. And another type of police was introduced slowly. And the feeling started to change. And there was this underlying tone of something's gonna happen.
Lay this out for me a little more, if you don't mind.
Yes. Well, you know, looking backwards, we all know when they instituted the Emergency Act, and that was on February 14th. And it was, you know, it was a time that scared a lot of people. You saw police come that weren't dressed like police anymore. They were dressed like what I would have worn in the military. And they had this look in their eyes that they were going to demolish you. Peaceful people, you know, that offered no resistance, no violence. You could tell they just wanted to destroy you. And slowly over that time, it got worse and worse, and people saw people were trampled by horses, shot with tear gas, rubber bullets, beaten with clubs. The veterans stood in line between the police and the people as a shield. And I should mention the one person, Chris Deering, his story I think most people know. He was a severely wounded veteran, and he was the lone survivor of a roadside bomb. He was engaging with the police. He said, you know, I'm here, I'm very, you know, severely injured. If you're going to arrest me, I'll go peacefully. Please don't hurt me. He was one of the first people they grabbed, pulled him out of the ranks, threw him to the ground, and three big officers were kicking him in his legs, his back, and his head. And he had his medals on, all the veterans did. Then, along with other people and other veterans, the police put them in the back of paddy wagons, drove them around erratically for a period of time, took them to a processing area, and dropped them off in minus 25 temperatures outside of town with no transport back. That's how you treat veterans and citizens.
Who do you think were these new police that came in?
I don't know. You know, you hear a lot of rumors that they came from offshore. I don't believe that myself personally. I believe a lot of them, you know, the ones that they're referring to were from Quebec someplace. And they were very happy to do what they did. Not all of them. I stood on the line and I saw, you know, I would look people straight in the eye and I would scan all the officers that I could see, and some would look away. Others would look like, I can't wait to beat your ass right now. Others were crying. There were several crying. They removed them pretty quick. A couple of passed out. But you felt this impending sense of, you know, violence coming. Citizens and ex-military people didn't return any violence. Nothing. Not a punch. Nothing. And to be beaten that way and treated like that, the world saw. They know what happened. And the narratives that came out, you know, the following day were, for example, the lady that was trampled with the horse. Chief Bell, the interim chief that was replacing the previous chief that they removed, said she threw her bike at the police, so that's how it happened. And that the video of her being trampled with her walker, by the way, was altered. So every narrative they tried to paint fell apart. They tried to start a fire in one of the buildings. That was proven to be false. They said that truckers and participants were stealing food from the homeless. That proved to be false. In fact, the food banks were turning food away. They had no room to store more food. I mean, the homeless people in Ottawa, they couldn't believe it. They were having a field day getting all the food, and they were eating so well. People, you know, you hear some of the citizens saying they have phantom honking to this day. Well, the citizens that I engaged with, they were so thankful that we were there, and there was hugs all around saying, I've never been able to walk the streets like this at night. I've never felt more safe. And, you know, you saw in some of the police documents, some of the videos during the inquiry, that even the police intelligence units were saying, this is the most peaceful thing that we could possibly imagine. There's no violence here. So, but the government tried to paint a very different narrative.
Well, and if I recall, you know, there was an ordinance passed to stop the honking, but as I understand it, the honking just stopped when that ordinance was instituted.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. It stopped instantly. And, you know, the other narrative that the trucks were blocking all of the streets, they weren't. If there was any streets blocked, it was blocked because of the police. They put up the barricades to block that street. We kept lanes open for safety purposes the whole way around the city. But the media painted a different picture. So, but people that were there knew the truth. And we're not there to harm anybody's safety. We were there to get a message across. You know, I'm speaking on behalf of the truckers in a sense. But it wasn't to take and hold a city hostage. It was to be heard. The honking was the first way that they could be heard. And then when, you know, the court ordered that they shouldn't do that, they complied completely.
So, you know, in your recollection, was there any kind of communication with the government that happened?
We tried. You know, I wasn't directly involved with communicating. I worked with some of the liaison officers from the police forces, and it was basically, they were just there to gather intelligence. They weren't really trying to engage to find, you know, solutions to different things. They were there to, you know, gather information so they could pass it to their superiors. We realized pretty quickly that that was pretty much a dead end. It just seemed that no one was listening. The leaders of the convoy, you know, they tried to engage with the government, and they just weren't having it. They just wouldn't engage at all.
Frankly, the whole convoy was described this way by multiple politicians and certainly many media as being some sort of extremist effort.
Well, they have to. They have to do that, because if you just say, hey, these are a bunch of nice people that showed up, but we're going to beat them and we're going to run them over with horses, that wouldn't look so good for them. So, you know, they have to paint you as Nazis and white supremacists and, you know, oh, there's Nazi flags everywhere. There's Confederate flags everywhere. I didn't see them. I saw, you know, after the fact, after the convoy, conveniently posed pictures of these things, but I know that the people that did see these called these people out immediately and got rid of them, because that's not what people were there for. I know that even during the court challenge, my testimony, they asked me those very questions. You know, they called me names, they wanted me to comment on the flags, and I just basically said I had no comment. But, you know, they actually called me those names.
Well, I would guess your lawyer, you know, had some thoughts about that.
He did, yeah. He didn't like that very much, and he jumped on that pretty quick, and they really had nothing else. That was the whole narrative during my testimony for the Emergency Act and the freezing of bank accounts. Mine was frozen as well.
So let's actually discuss that. What was the effect on you of your participation? You were there, you came, you talked on stage, you formed a sort of line, you faced off with police. There may be a few other things that you did that I didn't mention, but what was the reaction?
Yeah. To me personally, I felt betrayed. I've never convicted of a crime. I wasn't charged of a crime, and yet my government found it necessary to label me and freeze everything I own. Like, what did I do? Except speak up, just along like with everyone else. We just spoke up. We just wanted to be heard. They let me down. You know, I always believed in government and, you know, that your government would, you know, try to do the right thing for people. But since then, I realize they're only in it for themselves, it seems. We can't wait 4 years for an election sometimes. Sometimes you have to voice your concerns. And if you do it peacefully, that's a protected right under our Constitution to do that. But they didn't think that was so.
Well, you know, and Justice Mosley obviously agrees with that interpretation. What about, you know, what about the media?
Thank God we had so many independent and alternative medias, which you were one, in Ottawa, and got the story out to the world. Because the story the mainstream media or legacy media was painting wasn't the same picture. So there was a really complete opposite view of what was happening. And they should be ashamed of themselves. They really should. Nobody believes them anymore. We don't listen to them anymore because they basically are the ministry of truth in our eyes. And no wonder they're failing. And independent and alternate media is doing so well. But the governments are trying to crush those too, because they can't have that type of dissent. They want a specific message. So in Ottawa, all they wanted to do was paint hit pieces. Like, I had one person from the CBC wanted to do an interview. It got in my face in the Ark Hotel as I came out one day and said, oh, I'd really like to help you guys. We'd like to do an in-depth story. And I said, no thanks, I'm not really interested. I'm just here to help people out. I'm not here to do a story. And I said, you know, I don't hear so well, and you got a mask, and you're right in my face. Like, I'm sorry, I really don't understand half of what you're saying. 2 hours later, I happened to be coming out again. The same person ran up behind me with his mask off, and I didn't recognize him. And he said, oh, I'm the guy that spoke to you in the lobby. I said, well, how come you're not wearing a mask? He goes, oh, I only wear that on TV.
What did you think would happen?
It was just very aggressive when they came to me in the lobby. You know, in the military, you kind of get a sense of people's demeanor and how they approach you. It seemed hostile. It just did. Where when you were speaking to independents, they were much more interested in getting the story, not sort of inventing the story. They wanted to see what was really going on.
I've heard variations of what you just described in many different areas of human inquiry, you know, in many different countries. It doesn't seem to be an isolated thing.
It's true. People just wanted answers. They wanted dialogue. They wanted conversation, because things didn't seem to add up. It didn't make sense. What you see in your daily life to what you're being told on your television of what's happening during this whole pandemic didn't make sense. And you can't blame people for questioning things. I mean, anyone that stuck their head up, they had to do the best to actually, you know, get you fired from your job, paint you as a conspiracy theorist, whatever means they could use, they used that.
So you faced this situation where you could no longer use your money.
Well, I went to the cash machine on the Friday, and nothing worked. So I didn't have time to, I thought maybe the bank machine was empty, a lot of people were taking money out, they'd heard about things going down. So I tried to go online later that night when I had a moment to check, and I couldn't register in my account. So the next morning, Saturday morning, I called the bank, and I had a really strange conversation with an agent on the line. It was very vague, and they didn't know how to speak to me. And they said, well, you need to call the president. I went, call the president? I said, of what? And they said, of the bank. I said, okay, do you have his number? Well, no, we don't have the number. So I'm like, well, what's happened? Why is my account not working? And they had no answer. So there I was, no cash, no access to my credit cards, nothing. And I left on the Monday morning. I had other jobs that I had to take care of while I was there. And I had no money for gas. I had no money for lodging, nothing for food. If it wasn't for kindness of others and give me a few bucks, I don't know how I would have got home. And I live in New Brunswick. So if they wanted us to leave, why did they do that? You know, if you have no money to get anywhere, it didn't make sense to me. I realized just how vulnerable I am because of my finances. And I'm still struggling with that. It's hard to quantify into words how you feel when your government takes your money. Now, it was unfrozen later, but I don't keep anything in there anymore. I keep just enough to cover the bills. And I look over my shoulder, and the first moment I say something that maybe offends someone, they're gonna come knock at my door, or, you know, take me away in the middle of the night. That's how I feel. I hope that's not the case. But I've tried other banks, and quietly they've said to me, yeah, I wouldn't do that right now. We shouldn't really take you as a client. When I came to the U.S., I got to be honest, I was fearful that I would be taken in at the border. Luckily, I made it through okay, but what if I was over in other countries? Like, if I wanted to go to China or I wanted to go to Germany, would I find myself incarcerated because I'm on some list? I don't know. No one can tell me. They did say that publicly, that you'll be marked for life. For what? What did I do? How do you get marked for life for doing nothing?
there's a lot of different viewpoints on the truckers' protest. My own view is it was an incredibly consequential protest in stopping a lot of the mandates, various kinds of mandates in the world. And, you know, and that is viewed by many as an incredibly positive thing.
I think so, too. Mm-hmm. And that's the good thing about a democracy. We don't have to all agree. But I would like to live in a place that you have the right to speak up, even though I might disagree with you, to have a difference of opinion and be respectful to one another of that opinion. But it doesn't seem that way anymore. It's only if you have this opinion, you're okay. And Trudeau said that himself. The small fringe minority coming to Ottawa with unacceptable views. Well, who decides what's acceptable? I don't know. Is it the Ministry of Truth, which is now the mainstream legacy media? Democracies have to flourish, and you're not going to like what some people say, but that's okay. That's how it's supposed to work. You can't have everyone agree on everything, but that's what they want. It seems that way.
We talked a little bit about, you know, the impacts on yourself. What about, you know, your friends and family?
Yeah, well, I've lost a lot of friends, that's all I can say. But I, you know what, in spite of it all, there's a lot of people that I would have never met, some of the best people I've ever met in my life. It was the greatest experience. I have friends that are like family now. My family, some of my family blew me off, and they'll probably never talk to me again. It's unfortunate. I hope we can mend a fence one day. That's my cross to bear. That's like many, many Canadians and other people around the world. We have to find a way through this and come together, because our societies are just so divided right now. You know, it's so extreme, one side to the other. And here's your governments fueling that fire. Instead of trying to mend fences, they help to keep that division going. And it's a really sad state that, you know, our country and other countries around the world are in.
What is your hope, or what is your intention with this lawsuit? What is your hope it will accomplish?
The lawsuit that we've just launched is for the freezing of bank accounts. And you know what? If people disagree with what we did, I understand. That's okay. You can disagree. But think about this. If they froze my account because they didn't like what I said, what's to say that when it's your turn and you say something they don't like and they freeze your accounts, is that okay? This is such a dangerous precedent that they set. People should be alarmed. When you have a central bank digital currency, which they're trying to bring in, you're going to be a victim one day of government overreach, and you're not going to be able to do anything about it. So you need to pay close attention to this lawsuit, because this will affect you. Think of the seriousness of having everything you own frozen. You can't buy food, you can't buy medication, you can't pay your mortgage, you can't pay insurance, you can't put gas in your vehicle. That's pretty extreme. And do you think that your government would never use that tool again if this was okay? Who's to say where the line is? I don't know.
I guess your point here is that it shouldn't be the government deciding arbitrarily where that line is.
Yes, because governments will always try to gain more power. And it's up to the citizens in a democracy to speak up and say, you know what, you've gone too far. This has to be corrected. And, you know, the concentration of power that you're seeing in governments around the world, and especially in Canada, it's alarming. It really is alarming. And you need to pay attention. I think in a free society, you should have the right to free speech, not views that are acceptable, because when a new government comes, does that, what's acceptable, change? You know, some, like in Canada, you have a liberal government, or you could have a conservative government. They have a different perspective on, you know, the direction they want to take things economically and, you know, in the course of passing laws. So I would think that free speech is paramount to any democracy.
What do you think happened?
We were asleep at the wheel, all of us. we have a ruling class now, where instead of having a governing class, which the citizens, you know, are actively participating in government, they've decided that there are rulers. And that's just my opinion. But it seems like it's a top-down organization now, and you'll do as you're told, or we're going to punish you. And it's become extremely authoritarian. And we're creeping more and more to that line. And there's a line that you don't want to cross. And people that have lived in countries that that's happened, we have people from all over the world that migrate to Canada. They can see. They've lived this. They know. And they're warning people. It's like if you have a group of people standing on a train track and someone's yelling, hey, there's a train coming. Look over there. Get off the track. And there's, yeah, conspiracy theorists. Don't pay any attention. Nothing to see here. It's a warning. The old adage is, you can vote your way to tyranny, but you have to fight your way out. Let's hope that's not the case. Violence is not the answer to achieve an objective. You know, peaceful, engaged conversation. That's how it should be.
So you and a number of the veterans that were involved in the Freedom Convoy went out to start Veterans for Freedom. So I want to talk a little bit about that. You know, what it's about. I mean, it's in the name, so I think a lot of us will get that. But how did this come about, and what's the purpose?
Well, as a result of the convoy, five of us got together and said, you know, the unity that we saw from veterans coming together. Now, we don't speak for all veterans. I just want to make that clear. There's 460,000 veterans in Canada, and we're about 3,500 members across the country. But these are like-minded veterans that, you know, I want to stand up and say, you know, we need to protect people that are vulnerable and serve other veterans and, you know, bring attention to issues that are a concern to veterans and to people and help in any way that we can, you know, helping them raise money for people that are injured, you know, through, you know, COVID, through vaccines or whatever, try to assist them because our government is failing at helping people. They're asking for help and they're being turned away. So, you know, initially the government really came at us hard, Veterans for Freedom, as being, and some people were fueling the fire, oh, we're going to be some militia organization. In Canada, you can be arrested for trying to start a militia. We're not a militia. We're just a group of, you know, like-minded veterans that want to help people. That's it. And it's catching on. We're, you know, across the country, and people know us by the acts we've done already helping people. We've raised over $200,000 and helped, you know, many people across the country as much as we can, and we're not going to stop. So, and we, you know, we take in other members, not just veterans. We have supporters and we have patriots, and these are people that want to get involved and help us to do the job because nobody else is doing it. That's why we did it. And people get a certain sense of, I would say, I wouldn't say calm, but they have this feel when veterans show up to help you, they appreciate that because it says something to me. It's heartwarming. You know, we get a lot of hugs and a lot of tears. We really do.
Well, you know, there's a number of other lawsuits that are still playing out to this day. Tamara Lish is one that comes to mind. But I know there's multiple others. I know, you know, your, you know, friends or you stay in touch with some of these people. If there's any that you'd like to kind of update us on in the process here.
Sure. There is a number of lawsuits. Each one's slightly different, but all trying to achieve the same thing. And, you know, Tamara Leach and Danny Bulford and Tom Morazzo and a few others, they have an excellent lawsuit going. Ours is a little different. We have about 20 plaintiffs, and I think we have 32 defendants on this lawsuit. And it's a civil suit. And, you know, of course there's an ask for a judgment. People in Canada think, well, these people are just trying to get rich because, you know, their bank accounts were frozen. No, that's not it at all. That is not it. You know, the governments wield the power. So we have named right down from the prime minister, right down to the banks, to the police, to the anti-hate network, all the people that did this to us, they need to be held to account. And I don't want to, you know, I'm an older guy, I don't want to hand the world off to the next generation in a shambles.
You mentioned an anti-hate network. Tell me yes. about that.
Well, the anti-hate network was primarily the information organization that supplied all of the alternative narratives to the government. And they used that for their intelligence reports. So a lot of this that happened is as a result of information that came from them. So I won't say too much about that, but yeah, they played a big part in fueling the fire to create that, you know, narrative, that script of these are a bunch of people that want to overthrow the government, and they got Nazi flags, and they're, you know, they're beating up people, and they're stealing food. They were behind it. So they need to be held to account.
Any final thoughts as we finish?
Don't think there's nothing that you can do. Everybody has a role to play. And if your opinion is different than mine, that's okay. I'm not going to, you know, encourage people to squash your opinion, and I hope that you'll do the same to us. We need to get together as a country and move past this. This type of hate that we're experiencing over whatever the current issue is, we're not going to survive if we don't come together and move beyond it. Let's not let our government divide us and fuel that fire. That's all I ask. Just speak up. Speak up to your government and let them know that you're not happy with what they're doing.
Well, Eddie Cornell, it's such a pleasure to have had you on.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you all for joining Eddie Cornell and me on this episode of American Thought Leaders. I'm your host, Yanya Kelek.